We're here to talk about Paul's letter to the Romans. Nathan Ross is ready to begin chapter 4 next week. And so my job is to finish chapter 3 this week. And we have really camped in verses like 21 to 31, where we see man's hope in Christ. It's this incredible declaration of the gospel. And so we worked through it, and then we took it apart piece by piece a little bit. And so we want to look at what really is a postscript. Verses 21 to 26 describes the way a man or a woman, a sinner, can be made right with God. And if you summed it all up, you would say what the church has said now for hundreds, even thousands of years. A sinner is saved by grace through faith. That's what we learned in verses 21 to 26. All of us who are saved have been saved by grace through faith. It's a work of Christ. It's not our work. And therefore, there's no room for boasting. And that therefore there is no room for boasting is the postscript to that. It's the result of that. And that really does begin in verse 27. So, if you've got your Bibles open, Romans chapter 3, verses 27 to 31, maybe someone out there would read it for us. Somebody who has their Bible open. Mike Troyer has his Bible open, and he's kind of in the back, so we can all hear him. Mike, would you read it? Clearly, the Apostle Paul in that conclusion has the Jewish mindset in view. From chapter 1 all the way through this part of chapter 3, he has made clear that we understand that there is no distinction between the Jew and the Greek or the Jew and the Gentile. There's no peculiarity to the Jews in the sense that they are sinners just like the Gentiles are. They're saved just like the Gentiles are. And while he's made that case, he's kind of coming back to it here in this postscript to say once again that the law couldn't save anybody, and by the law then the Jew is not advantaged. The Gentile had a law unto themselves, right? We studied that. Even without the law of God, they have the law written on their hearts. But that law doesn't gain a Gentile anything. The fact that a person knows right from wrong doesn't make them right. It only reveals how wrong they are. And the fact that the Jews were given the law of God, the revelation of God's expectation, doesn't make them righteous. It only reveals how unrighteous they are. And that's kind of Paul's point that you heard Mike read, that you can see there in your text, that the law does not justify anybody. So he has been celebrating that the only way we can be justified is by grace. It's a gift. It's not a work. And it's grace through faith. And his point here is the same, right? You can see it there in verse 27. The law that now works is a law of faith. A man, verse 28, is justified by faith. It's not the works of the law. And it's the same way the Jew and the Gentile is both saved. So it is faith for the circumcised. It is faith for the uncircumcised. It doesn't matter. A person is saved, a man or a woman, a sinner is saved by faith. So because we are saved through faith, we could say it this way, because that's the truth, there's no room for boasting. That's in these verses. Because that's the truth, there's hope for everybody. And because that's the truth, all right, because that's the truth, there's no room for boasting. Because that's the truth, there's hope for everybody, because there's no distinction as it regards faith. And because that's true, real change is possible. All right? So those three things would be how I would outline these verses. Because we are justified by grace through faith, there's no room for boasting. Because a man or a woman is justified by grace through faith, then there's no advantage to anyone. There's hope for everybody. And because a man or a woman is justified by grace through faith, real change is possible. The change that the law could never bring, whether it's the Mosaic law, God's law, or the law written on human hearts, can't produce change. This law of faith, which he calls it in verse 26, can produce change. Real change is possible where genuine faith abides. Now, you might want to underline that in your heart and mind, those of you who call yourselves Christians and refuse change for the better. righteous pursuits. Those of you who call yourself Christians and cling stubbornly to sinful patterns and call it okay by grace, where grace increases, where sin increases, grace increases all the more. Now, the Apostle Paul here says that if you have genuine saving faith, there should be real change in your life. All right, so those three things. Because you're saved by grace through faith, there is no room for boasting. Because you're saved by grace through faith, there's hope for everybody. And if you're saved by grace through faith, real change is possible. Now, for all that to happen, this salvation by grace through faith has to deal with sin, right? That's what salvation is. It's God's means by which He deals with our sin so that we might be reconciled to Him. So if I asked you, what is the worst sin of all? Would the Bible make an argument for any particular sin? The worst of sins. What might you think? Or you might think the Bible doesn't. I'm going to suggest up front the Bible does make a case for that the worst of sins is. Or maybe we might call it the root of all sin. What would you say that is? Unbelief? Yeah, that's a good answer. But I'm talking about the act that unbelief produces. The disobedience that unbelief produces. What'd you say?
Pride.
The Bible will make a case that in an unbeliever, the manifestation of their unbelief is most clearly seen through pride. How's that for connecting Hank and Pam? In an unbeliever's life, the most clear manifestation of their unbelief is the sin of pride. Pride, we might say, is at the root of this massive tree of sinful disobedience among humans. I say that to say this. If the gospel is effective, it must be effective at the point of pride. Is that fair? If pride is one of those roots, maybe the tap root of all sins, and the gospel of Jesus Christ comes to deal with sin and make real change possible, then it's going to have to be effective at dealing with pride. So here's what C.S. Lewis writes about the gospel and pride. There is one vice of which no man in the world is free, which everyone in the world loathes when he sees it in somebody else, and of which hardly any people except Christians ever imagine that they're guilty of. I've heard people admit that they're bad-tempered, or that they can't keep their heads about girls, or about their drink, or even that they're cowards. But I don't think I've ever heard anyone who was not a Christian accuse himself of this vice. And at the same time, I have seldom met anyone who was not a Christian who showed the slightest mercy to this vice in another person. There is no fault which makes a man more unpopular, and no fault which we are more unconscious of in ourselves. And the more we have it ourselves, the more we dislike it in others. The vice I'm talking about is pride. We hate pride when we see it in someone else, and we almost never acknowledge it ourselves. The answer lies in the very nature of pride. So Lewis goes on, pride is essentially competitive. Competitive by its very nature. While the other vices are competitive only, so to speak, by accident, pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. We say, for instance, that people are proud of being rich, or proud of being clever, or proud of being good-looking, but they're not. What they're proud of is being richer, or cleverer, or better-looking than somebody else. That's what they're proud of. If everyone else became what you are, or imagine yourself to be, if everyone else had what makes you so proud, then you wouldn't be proud anymore. The pleasure is found in thinking you rise above somebody else. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? So pride is, in its essence, a competitive thing. It's where I think I'm better than, or where you think you're better than. The Christians are right, Lewis writes. It is pride which has been the chief cause of misery in every nation and every family since the world began. Other vices may sometimes bring people together, You may find good fellowship and jokes and friendliness among the drunks or among the unchaste people. But pride always means enmity. It is enmity, he says. And not only enmity between man and man, but enmity between man and God. Pride. If the gospel is effective to bring about change, it's going to have to be effective in tackling pride. Now, if you'll turn in your Old Testament to the book of Isaiah chapter 14, we get a record of the destruction of pride the first time it manifests itself. So in order to see the record of pride the first time it ever manifests itself, knowing that it manifests itself in the Garden of Eden, which we'll get to in a minute, that means we're going back before time, or before creation at least. And that's what the writer of Isaiah does in Isaiah chapter 14. And he takes us back in time before the garden, before creation. He takes us into heaven, or the place where God lived or lives. Not before the creation of anything, but before the creation of the earth, there was the creation of the angelic beings. And among the angelic beings, there was one angelic being who was, well, seemingly more blessed than any other. And Isaiah is referencing that angelic being, Lucifer himself. And in verse 12 of chapter 14, here's what he writes. How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You've been cut down to the earth. You have weakened the nations. But you said in your heart, this is where it started. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Now you can follow along. Go back there to verse 13. And here is Lucifer speaking to himself. I, one, I, two, three, four, five times, I will. This is pride. This is the manifestation of self-will with a desire to be better than the other. And it would be one thing, and he does say that I will be better than the other angels. That's what he means when he says, I'll ascend above the heights of the clouds. It's one of the pictures we have of angels, not because they float around on clouds, but the idea is they are these angelic beings. They're elevated. They're around the throne of God. And Lucifer says, I can rise above them. So it's one thing to say I can be better than everyone else like me, but that's not really all that he wants, is it? You can see what he wants. He wants to be better than, or at least equal with, the Most High God. This is a manifestation of pride in a magnified sense. It's hard to imagine that level of avarice and anger that must have fueled that kind of passion to say, I can be better than, or to imagine even that he is better than, because he states it certainly, I will be this. It's just a matter, he thinks, of his own will measuring his potential. And he had tremendous potential. If you look back up to verse 11, your pomp and the music of your harps. This was a gifted angel, gifted musically, which we would understand around the throne of heaven was only gifted musically for one purpose, to bring praise to God. And here is this gifted musician who now seeks to bring praise to himself. And prophetically speaking, God is saying, though he has this musical gift to bring praise to God, verse 11, you are brought down to the grave. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you. Worms are your covering. And he says that again in verse 15. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. What is it that caused Lucifer to fall? Pride. and he falls and is cast out of heaven, thrown to the earth, and made to crawl around on his belly. And there we recognize him, and he's identified in the Garden of Eden as the serpent. And so he comes slithering along to Eve one day and tempts her with what? Pride. You can be like God. You can be better than everything, everyone else. Now don't miss the fact that when he said to her, you can be like God, absent at least a direct communication with Adam, though we don't imagine Adam was absent, he is also saying to her what? You can be better than him. You can be better than him. Oh, he was first, but that doesn't mean anything. You can be better than him. You were created to complete him, but that doesn't matter. You can be better than him. And then after the fall, of course, the curse elicited by God is to simply let pride have what pride wants. The curse that sits on every woman since that day. You say, well, what is the curse? Simple, it's pride. You can be better. You can be first. You don't have to follow the order. Pride. Well, what was the curse against the man? The reaction of wounded pride. The man's pride is wounded by the woman's pride, and he reacts to dominate her. That's the curse. The curse is really rightly understood, and certainly understood in the context of that first fall of Lucifer and the temptation that he purveyed. The curse is pride. It strikes at the heart of what fallen man thinks about himself or herself. And so again, if this idea of the gospel of salvation by grace through faith can affect any real change, it's going to have to change us at that level, at the level of pride. So I'm just wondering this morning, which of you would be humble enough to admit your pride publicly? What are you proud of this morning? Is there a good sense in which we can be proud? What are you proud of? You can be very prideful at work. Yeah, and in the marketplace, that's pretty common, right? Because the marketplace is measured by what? Output. It has a meter clicking on it. Some way or another, everything in the marketplace is measured by output. And so it's pretty easy to look at your meter and compare it to the other guy's meter, right? My output's better than his output. And that's pride. We are taught to have pride in what we do. And that's really where I'm going with this. So hold on to that thought. Answer. So there's the tendency to be proud of your work. Sean is suggesting in a sinful way. But Sean, should you be proud of your work? Yep. I do know what you're saying. Answer the question, though, yes or no. Should you be proud of your work? Not in that sense. See, Sean's being very careful because we should be very careful about this, and we're not. See, we should be proud of the work we accomplish only so that God could receive glory by what He's accomplishing through us. And then we would say there's no room for pride. There's no room for pride there. But it's hard for us. I mean, you said we were taught to be proud. Now, you didn't put a period there. You said we were taught to be proud of what we do, meaning do it well. But really, you could put a period there. Certainly in Western culture, we are taught to be proud. We're Americans, after all, right? We celebrate our pomposity regularly. And that's pride. Now, maybe different cultures think of it differently, and they do, but this is our culture. And when I ask the question, what are you proud of? Your first tendency is to kind of qualify it. I want to do things excellently, but I don't want to be prideful. What else are you proud of? This is the other way we go. One way is we qualify our pride. What's the other way we go? We deflect it on others. So a parent might say, I'm not proud, but I'm sure proud of my boy. I am. right? And then we're taught as good parents that we should tell them that, how proud we are of them. And so I just want you to see, I'm not trying to rework Western culture, and I'm not trying to minimize the great gift of grace that being an American is, a gift which we had nothing to do with. It's providence for most of us. But we have to wrangle with this idea that if the gospel is going to cripple our pride, we have to own that sin and all its shapes and forms, and then let the gospel inform us in that area. Sean's already taken us to the end of it, right? He took us straight to the benediction. There's no room for pride when I finally realize that it's not me, but God at work in me. But see, we don't use that language. We don't look at Johnny and say, I'm proud of you. I mean, we don't look at Johnny and say, I'm proud of God at work in you. We look at Johnny and say, I'm proud of you. So maybe Christian parents, we're hearing something we need to think about more carefully. The things we should celebrate, not necessarily the home run, but those moments where you see God at work in your child in a peculiar way, like an act of kindness. Boy, I'm proud that you let your brother play with that toy first. Well, maybe. But if we were careful, would it not be better to say, it brings me great joy to see God at work in your life that moves you to give your brother that toy first? Because, now, he's only three, so go easy on him, right? Because you wouldn't ordinarily do that because you're prideful. Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. What he's talking about is even the cautions we give can lead us to pride. Like saying, I'm humble. Well, that's prideful. So it can be tricky. That's the point, is it can be tricky. Well, there's places in our lives where we show our pride. Our human accomplishment, as Sean mentioned, in the marketplace or in the home or baking a cake or cooking dinner, and boy, you back up, right, and you flip your apron and say, ha, ha, I'm proud of that one. And then your husband comes home and he says, artichokes, really? I did that. I could not eat it. I mean, it was beautiful. We hadn't been married a week, and I'm thinking, really? Artichokes? It's a tricky thing, but we do that, right? We look at it and we say, wow, look what I did. Look what I did. So it's us, but it's our relationships. I'm proud of Johnny. I'm proud of my pastor. I'm proud of my church. We have to be careful in all those areas. And then really at the heart of what Paul is saying is I'm proud of my faith. I'm proud of the fact that I'm a Christian. At that place where life means more than it'll ever mean in any other area, your eternal relationship with God, pride strikes and says, look what kind of Christian you are. Yeah, that's good. Look what you believe. Look how confident you are. Look how quickly you rise above the fray. And pride seeps in at religion's feet. And that's what the Apostle Paul is really most concerned in, because if pride can't be crippled there, it's a waste of time to try to cripple it in your flesh. Pride has to be crippled at the spiritual level of our existence if we're going to have any hope at crippling it in our flesh. So pride will often clothe itself in self-righteousness. Turn over to Luke, the Gospel of Luke, familiar story of the Pharisee and the tax collector. Luke chapter 18. Is the record of that. You can find it in verse 11. By the way, verse 9 says this is a parable. So it's a picture, a graphic picture to describe a profound truth. And he says in verse 10, it's two men, and they've gone to the temple to pray. It's religion on display. And here's two men practicing their religion. One's a Pharisee and the other's a tax collector. One is a man of high reputation, the other is a man of couldn't be lower reputation. Nobody likes a tax collector. It's funny, isn't it? 2,000 years later, we still feel the same way about tax collectors. I have never had a church member or met a Christian who was a tax collector. Now, that doesn't mean tax collectors can't be Christians. It's just never been my pleasure. And I think it's because they were and wouldn't tell me. Right? I mean, would you tell somebody if you were? I don't know. But anyway, here's a tax collector, low rung, Pharisee high rung. And the Pharisee stood and was praying this to himself. And you know this, most of you know this by heart. God, I thank you. So stop right there. You see, Chuck said, isn't thankfulness a better approach? And then Mr. Dudley, in the wisdom of his years and his insight into Scripture, understands that even that can become a source of pride. It can become an expression of pride, and that's what this guy's doing. This guy's not going to fall to the, my Bible's so heavy that my stand will not stand. This guy is not going to fall to the typical prideful expressions. He's learned how to overcome that. He overcomes it with gratitude. So look what he says. I am so thankful, God. I thank you, God. Great start. I thank you that I'm not like other people. Now, we could stop right there and the Pharisee could be saying, I am so thankful for the change that you've made in my life. And you've made me not like other people. You've made me not a swindler. I think he says swindler there. You've made me not unjust. You've made me not an adulterer. You've made me not like that guy. That guy over there. I am so thankful that you've made me not like him. So we could give him credit and say that's really what he means, and it would not get him off the hook, would it? Because he's still saying the same thing. I am thankful, God, that I'm better than him. I'm better than him. I have risen above him. I'll give God the credit for it, and God doesn't want the credit for you thinking you rose above somebody else. But that's the Pharisee's perspective. I'm better than him. In fact, it's obvious that I'm better than him, verse 12. I fast twice a week. So I just want you to understand this is gratitude expressed in religious devotion. Do you see it? I'm thankful. Here's how thankful I am. I fast twice a week. And not only that, I pay tithes of everything I get. I'm obviously better than that guy. I'm obviously better than him. You can see it in my what? In my religion. You can see it in my devotion. You can see it in my fasting and my giving. Well, Jesus goes on. The tax collector is over there some distance away. And he wouldn't even lift his eyes up to heaven, but rather was beating his breast saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. Not a sinner. The article there in the Greek is definite. Have mercy on me, the sinner. It's the same as Paul's perspective, right? When he said, I look at my own life and I am the greatest sinner of all. That's the right perspective. It's the contrary to pride perspective, is that I'm not better than anybody. I'm worse than everybody. That's what the tax collector is saying. There are a lot of people in the temple this day, he might look around and say, that are here for all sorts of reasons, some good, some not so good. And I look at this audience, I look at this crowd, and I'm the sinner here today. That's who I am. And he doesn't even have the confidence to lift his eyes to heaven. He has no presumption of God's grace. Why would God be merciful to the sinner? Why would he be that way? Yet he has heard, and he has learned and he's understood that God is merciful to sinners. If God wasn't merciful to sinners, he would have no mercy. Because we're all sinners. So do you see the stark distinction? One man says, I'm better than everybody else and I'm thankful to God for that. And it's really obvious. And the other man says, I'm worse than everybody else. And my only hope is the mercy of God. And the lesson is unpacked in verse 14. The man who thought himself less than anyone went to his house justified. The other man didn't. Because anyone who exalts himself, anyone who is prideful, anyone whose pride reaches into their righteous devotion before God, if pride strikes you at the level of your faith, you're damned. There's no justification for you. That's what Jesus says. No justification for that man. He did not go home justified. because pride had struck at the level of his faith. And as all of his expressed gratitude toward God, he couldn't hide it. He thought he was better than somebody else. And that man who has that sort of pride, well, he'll be humbled. But if you humble yourself, you'll be exalted. You'll see something worthy of pride one day, and it won't be of your own doing. Someone will lift you up. If you won't lift yourself up, if you'll stop doing that, someone one day will lift you up. God Himself. Now, when you see that phrase, having read Isaiah, and it says that that man with pride will be humbled, you know what that means, right? Just like Satan. Just like Lucifer. What does that mean? Thrown into a pit and maggots will destroy you. Thrown into a fiery furnace where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Take all your pictures of the afterlife for the unbeliever, the afterlife of the prideful, and that's all wrapped up in that you will be humbled one day. A lake of fire prepared for Lucifer and those that fell with him, not prepared for men, yet will become the abode of all the prideful. All the prideful will spend all eternity maggot infested. Right? Crying out in misery. That's the picture. So this pride is a real deal, and what we're talking about is pride that strikes at faith. Strikes at who you are and how you relate to God and how your relationship with God then causes you to relate to other people. A couple of truths about pride. Proverbs, you know this. Pride comes before the fall. In fact, Proverbs 16:18 in the NASB said, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before stumbling. That's important to get the second half of that. Pride comes before the fall. You say, well, I haven't fallen yet. Yeah, but you're tripping all over yourself. That's the idea. Before you fall, you'll trip all over yourself. Just pay attention. You'll see it coming. That's the idea. James chapter 4 in the New Testament. God gives grace to the humble, to the one who sees themselves as the sinner. But that's not all it says. God resists the proud. You want to go to war with God? Is that your plan? We say, no, who would want to do that? Well, if you're prideful, that's what you're doing. If there's any element of your faith that allows room for self-righteousness, worthiness, accomplishment, effort, anything that you imagine has gained you favor, pride has a hold of your faith and it will destroy you. That's what the Bible teaches. Here's C.S. Lewis again. How is it that people who are quite obviously eaten up with pride can say that they believe in God and appear to themselves to be very religious? I'm afraid it means they're worshiping an imaginary God. They theoretically admit themselves to be nothing in the presence of this phantom God, but are really all the time imagining how he approves of them and thinks far better of them than ordinary people. That is, they pay a penny worth of imaginary humility to him and get out of it a pound's worth of pride toward their fellow man. Do you know anybody like that? I hope you're doing this. And when I ask you who, you say, me. This has plagued evangelical Christianity in America, perhaps unlike any other sin. The idea that we're better than other people. That even when confronted with our sin, we say things like, well, I'm a sinner, but not like that. Or we read and watch the cultural dialogue of homosexuality and we say, I'm so thankful, God, that I'm not like that. Or adultery or pornography. I mean, I may be guilty of some things, I'll admit that, but I'm not like that. See, that's us. That's so often us. That's been so often our pulpits. That's been our preachments. And what we're learning, what the Apostle Paul is driving home is, pride has a hold of your faith, and it'll destroy you. Because salvation is by grace. It's applied through faith. Where then comes this boasting? Where could you ever imagine that you're better than someone else? That's the idea. So salvation by grace through faith undercuts pride, and I'll just list you a few things and we'll be done real quickly. Number one, if you can accept and truly believe that salvation is by grace alone, then it undercuts this idea of morality, this idea that you actually are better. That's all I mean by that. That your life is measured against others' lives, and by that you're better. The Apostle Paul said, I've looked at my life. You know this text. I've looked at my life, and I find no offense there. I could measure myself against others, but that's not profitable. But I've measured myself against myself, and I find no wrong there. And then he adds these words, because that sounds very prideful. But he adds these words, but I am not by that acquitted. Just because I can't see it does not mean that I am what I think I am. Because he would say of himself in Romans 7, I know that in me there is no good thing. I just wonder how many of us as American Christians raised in a Protestant context, how often during the day do you ever let that thought cross your mind? I know that in me there is no good thing. That is, Paul says, in my flesh. Or are you guilty of riding down the road and taking a glance in a mirror and saying, man, I follow you guys on Instagram. I see those pictures where you make yourself look 10 pounds lighter. Perfect hair. But you know what's curious about us? I read this the other day, 40%. That sounds like a too big a number, but then I kind of scrolled my Instagram feed. It's pretty close. 40% of the posts that we make about ourselves are pictures of food we eat. Now, that's a curious perversion of pride, isn't it? That somebody else would want to look at what you're eating, because the imagination is what? That what you're eating is better than what they're eating. Don't you wish you were eating what I was eating? And we chuckle at this, but this is the reality of where we live. We are eat up with pride. All right, so morality. I'm better. I just am better. The Bible says what? Nathan taught us, there's no one righteous, no one. You're not better. You're not. Say that. I'm not better. That's like a Joel Osteen moment there. That was kind of cool. Second thing. Let the doctrine of salvation by grace alone crush your morality in the sense of imagining yourself better. Secondly, let it crush your pious feelings. One pastor wrote that in times past, we worried about being better, actually doing better than other people. But in the present time, all we think about is feeling better than everybody else. I don't have to be better. I've got to feel better. Boy, I feel good about myself today. And again, Facebook, Instagram, right? It's all over. I'm having a good day today, or I'm having a bad day today, or pray for my day today, or hashtag lift me up, or hashtag help me smile, and it's all pride. It's all pride. It's this idea that I need to feel better about myself, pious feelings. And if I could feel okay, I would what? Finish it. Be okay. If I could just feel okay, I would be okay. Well, you're not okay. And I don't want anybody to be depressed and despondent, and I know that can be a plague on even believers, maybe even especially believers. But the answer is not feeling better about yourself. That is not the answer. That's the devil taking pride into your depression and crucifying you with it.
Is that self-esteem?
Absolutely. Yes. Welcome to just the public, right? It's all about self-esteem.
But we get it
started. And we thank you for that, Michael. What grade are you teaching?
Fifth grade.
Fifth grade. Well, you're not starting it then. It's the preschoolers that are starting.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, third. All right, let the doctrine of grace crush your moral measurement of yourself. Let it crush your pious feelings. Thirdly, let it crush your knowledge. Some people actually think they're going to be saved by the superior knowledge and understanding of the doctrines of grace. And that's a peculiar kind of pride that is absolutely deadly. I'm better than you among all of you like me who have been saved by grace. And I'm better than you because I understand it better than you. And if you just understood it a little better, well, then you wouldn't be depressed and you wouldn't be this or you wouldn't be that. You just need to understand a little better. And that's at its core in the early church is Gnosticism, this idea that somehow they've attained to a higher knowledge. And if you just were in on that, everything would be okay. And we do that. We have to be really careful about that in churches like this, where we try to commit ourselves to a deep understanding of the doctrines of grace, of the profound truths of the gospel, of really trying to take apart something that's so common as the Lord's Supper and trying to see in it what Christ really meant, and then going and having lunch with your friend who goes to another church and saying, boy, if you only knew what we knew. If you only thought like we think. And it's pride. And it doesn't mean we don't want to confront error with truth, but I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about a superiority that attaches itself to this idea of a higher knowledge of the deeper things of God. And then here's perhaps the most pernicious of all, and we'll end here because my time's up. Let the doctrine of salvation by grace through faith destroy your pride in faith. Because this is what I grew up in. It was my faith that saved me. And the doctrine of salvation by grace through faith destroys the idea that my faith saved me. Because my faith can't save me. No faith can save me. Christ alone can save me. And He affords by His mercy the grace I need, and it travels on a faith that was given to me. And I would just say here that among Protestant congregants in the United States today, based on the numbers from those who measure such thing, the vast majority of them worship under that guise every Sunday. My faith saved me. And the devil has a grip on those churches in a way that is absolutely damning. And what we've learned together through Nathan's exposition of Romans that says you're worthless, and Paul's instruction of the worth of Christ is that our faith is nothing. The faith that saves is a gift. It's not a work. It's not mine. So that no man can boast. It is the gospel that destroys faith. Destroys it. And if you struggle with faith and you read the book of James, it says, humble yourself before God. What is he teaching you? He's teaching you to go back to the gospel and be reminded once again that there is no room for boasting. There's no room for boasting. Quickly, just because I said it's in the text and so Nathan doesn't have to feel compelled to have to clean up my mess. Verse 31 says, do we then nullify the law through faith? This idea of a standard of righteousness by which we might manifest the real work of God in our lives. Look what Paul says. May it never be. No, the gospel of grace establishes the law. We'll come back to this again later in Romans as the application is applied after chapter 12. But here's simply what Paul is saying. Believing that will produce real change. It will do in your life what the law could never do. All right, you got it? Where then is boasting? Gone. Gone. You're dismissed.